This is the fifth and last episode of the series Futures, in which we interview key players in the design scene working in the public sector in Europe. We have planned this series with Anni Leppänen as part of her larger research for understanding the current change in the government and the design sector. We wanted to envision collaboratively how this could be in 2030. This series has interviews describing cases in Denmark, Sweden, Estonia, and the UK. Jesper is a public innovation thinker and practitioner with a background in anthropology. His work focuses on how to deal with public problems in order to pursue the common good, in particular through better ecosystems for research and development. He's working in the State of Change, a non-profit organization based in Australia and operating around the globe. They work on collective learning in issues such as inequalities, climate change, and social justice. In this interview, we talk about changing our mindset and habits, learning collectives, and systemic transformation. My name is Mariana Salgado. This is Diseño y Diáspora. I start recording from here. Would you like to present yourself?
Sure. My name is with a designer's background and studied anthropologist, but I've been working most of my career innovation in either within or with government.
And now you are working in States of Change. Okay, what is?
Yeah, so it's maybe just to be very clear, I'm working. I have two kind of roles right now. Sort of a primary role in a big group foundation, which I can return to in the example of the work that you are asking for. And then I am a co-founder of States of Change. States of Change was an idea myself and a few colleagues sort of had almost 10 years ago at this point, but certainly 7 or 8 years ago. And it actually started from two different challenges, I think. One was, you know, this increased proliferation of labs, innovation labs being established and set out to support innovation. And they felt very on demand in terms of the challenge. If the challenge is to actually build the capacity for government to innovate or for government to certainly serve its people better in relation to complex challenges. And on the other hand, we saw the providers of innovation learning being maybe not well positioned to deliver the actual support that the government officials need if they are to transition into new ways of working. And that includes both consultancy and scientific research and schools of government and all those sorts of entities. So in a way, what we saw the need for was to really invest in a global ecosystem of innovation practice, where some of the focal points was around developing a new curriculum for innovation learning, public innovation learning. And some of it was also about making some of the ambitions of the more progressive governments, if you will, that actually wanted to transform themselves, to actually make some of them support them in showcasing what that could look like. So we've basically gathered a global network of innovation practitioners to both help us support ambitious governments, but also help us in a way become a live practice curriculum for public innovation that obviously reinvented over time in terms of their own experiences. But it was important that this was about being based practice experience as the focal point, rather than the theoretical ideas about how innovation is supposed to work, which tends to dominate some of the learning around innovation.
So if I understood it too well, you have this network of different experts that go to different governments and provide certain trainings, but they are working with the real cases of their own challenges.
Yeah, and they're working from their own practical experiences as the starting point. I guess the consequence of that is that it puts weight on slightly different things in terms of both what you're learning, but also how you learn in terms of the more intangible nature of changing your mindset, changing your habits, changing how you see the purpose of your role, that sort of thing. It's almost like you're working to support a transition of public officials to a new professional identity in some cases, right? So it's a very different ballgame if you compare it to, I guess, at that time when we started, there was a lot of delivery of kind of weekly trainings and design thinking or, you know, a two-day sprint on data science or whatever it might be. You know, there was very much focused on the shiny methods as opposed to the actual doing of the work and the implications that these methods might have on the functions and the role of government officials.
Could you tell us an example of the, like something from the curriculum, like what would be like a new skill or new part of the skills for public innovation?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to think about where to start that one. So part of the curriculum was also to have a bit of a, I guess, a straw man in terms of what does this future way of working actually look like, and what should our assumptions be based on what other innovation practitioners would have experienced in terms of what it means to be, what it takes to innovate. And what we found there is that the skills is important and they're teachable, but the mindset and the attitudes around government officials is something that needs to be reactivated or re-engaged with. So a lot of the learning of the curriculum was actually focused on mindset training, if you will. And obviously there were some areas of work. We had three overall areas that we typically looked at in terms of learning or accelerating learning, in terms of collaboration, and in terms of leading change. And within that, depending on the case, I mean, we always partner with public servants that are working on a particular challenge. And within that work, we would try to set up, you know, a learning support system where, for example, if this were required you to be more citizen engagement led, it's not just about learning new methods to engage the citizens or to interview them or, you know, or taking those kinds of data back. It's also about when you then have done that throughout the process, thinking with the mindset of engaging your end user and having empathy towards their situation and a new relationship to them continuously. So it goes from this sort of one-off activity to an actual awareness and ability to think about that mindset in a lot of different situations throughout that period of time. And that requires rehearsal and reflection and meaning-making because, you know, it takes very different, it looks different in different situations. And it's always not always easy to see what actually is the implication for what I'm supposed to do as a public servant right now. So so we've done that sort of work a lot with officials working on, for example, Indigenous rights in Canada, or with officials working on social service systems in Australia or whatnot. But the important thing is actually to sustain that practice requires, you know, to rehearse that empathy, professional empathy muscle. That's just one attitude out of a range of them that is important to kind of have more in play as you perform your professional responsibility.
And what do you do to sustain that new attitude?
Yeah, what do you do? I mean, the most important thing is to in a way reframe your work as a bit of an experimental platform or experimental journey. So in a way, you have to have a learning-based approach. So when you try something out that is different than what you're usually doing, you obviously have to reflect on how that went, how that felt, how that was enabled, how did that fail, or whatever it might be. So a lot of kind of what's important there is to create the space to both try, but also to reflect, adapt, and try again. And these spaces are normally not available, I guess, for public servants. Then I guess one of our contributions with States of Change when we partnered with governments was to create that space, but also to support the reflection and the meaning making, and then also facilitate peer-to-peer learning around those experiences. So in a way, you become wiser in the conversation with your colleague. And that was actually a big principle in how we approach things. We didn't talk about, well, I guess we talked about it as learning programs, but in reality, what was happening was we would try to create learning collectives, and we would look at all the participants, including the main facilitators, the innovation experts, if you will. But they were just part of a group that needs to kind of have a collective learning experience. So in a way, it was also about us learning from them in their context about what's actually possible. And a lot of it is not something you can figure out the answer to in advance, but you have to sort of facilitate that learning environment over time to really discover it.
I think many designers or design-minded civil servants, maybe they are struggling to get mandate to work in such a way, because what you were describing, maybe it requires time and also permission to do things in a very different way, and be maybe more open-ended, and you know, there's emerging things and you need to be open to that. So do you have any tips for designers who want to be creating that kind of mindset change that you were describing, like how to get the mandate, or how to get space for that in your daily work? Like, it's so easy to be in the sort of roller coaster of the daily work to kind of get out of that and get mandate to do something as you were describing.
I mean, I think what is interesting right now is that there is a bit of a trend at the moment, given the, I guess, increased recognition of the challenges we are facing, and increased recognition for something like, for example, more long-term systemic transformational initiatives. That with that comes also a shift away from the quick fix and the focus on the project that's going to fix everything, towards a more sustained series of learning-oriented explorational, you know, initiatives, or whatever you might call them, which, you know, has to be driven by that mindset that we're talking about, particularly learning orientation and experimental approach, and so on. So it's increasingly becoming a requirement, and something that I even see now in at least some places in Denmark, in job descriptions of those sorts of roles, that you actually have to be able to have that sort of mindset. So on one hand, there is a bit of a formalization of this importance. On the other hand, so there's a part of the mandate that comes with that, I think. But then another part is to say, to in a way shift the emphasis of, you know, in a way away from traditional professions, including, you know, the design profession, and say, well, actually, it's not about being a designer or an anthropologist or a political scientist, but it is about finding a common collaborative approach, which has some new kinds of principles. And so in a way, a part of the mandate comes when you achieve that sort of feeling that we're all in the same boat, that we're actually in here with a common mission, common agenda, common approach, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's really important as well.
This interview is part of the list Futures in Public Sector, Dinamarca y Diseño, Futuros y Diseño. The list can be found in our website, in YouTube, and in Spotify. Jesper makes important questions. One of them is how to facilitate collective learning environments over time. In Finland, we have a network of designers working for the public sector, and this network has now more than 500 participants. We have sometimes in-person events, but also we have every Thursday an online meeting in which one of us presents recent work. Around 70 persons, or sometimes even more, come weekly to these meetings, and the presentations are really good quality. Also the discussions after the presentations. These Thursday meetings have lasted for many years. This is really a collective learning environment built and sustained by peers. We are all of us learning in creative and collective ways. Listening to podcasts is one collective way of learning, not only because podcasts allowed us to better listen to each other, but also because of the variety of voices that podcasts are offering. This podcast is also about collective and multilingual learning that goes beyond geographical borders. I have interviewed more than 500 persons working with a design perspective over 5 years. The fact that I mostly do it in Spanish gives a Global South perspective that enriches this collective learning. Let's continue listening to Jesper, that he has a lot more to tell. We are seeing big changes and experiencing them, both, you know, in what is going on politically around the world and what is going on in the way in which we are operating and we are working. So as we want to think in the future, how could you say that we will be changing our practices in the future?
I guess just taking kind of the, we are in 2024, so this is 6 years away. One of the things that have emerged as beginning to really make an impact is this idea of systemic transformation or systemic change, this idea of mission orientation, as opposed to just doing kind of more traditional policy development within siloed areas. And those two together actually really allows for a much broader and much more long-term push for more kind of, you know, more fundamental changes in different areas. Obviously, some are obvious, some are less obvious, but so working with marginalized youth, for example, as I'm currently doing, we have an increased amount of actors moving into this space and moving into that recognition. So you have a lot of both private and public organizations, you have a civil society, you have interest organizations, you have a lot of big players that are actually pushing for a different approach. And the implication of that approach, one of them, is that there's a new dynamic between bottom-up and top-down. It becomes much more of a way of taking collective societal responsibility around these missions. Becomes much more about looking beyond your own organization in terms of what you're currently doing, what you say your purpose is, as opposed to what your role can be in a larger context. And it becomes much more about for government to accept the role as a steward of transformation, or play maybe not the dominant part in that, but play a sort of a proactive and helpful part of that mission-based approach. So that means, and this is one of the things that we are actually experimenting with at the moment, that means opening up policy to engage with relevant actors around what you think you want to try, what you probably need to learn more about, even though you might have some assumptions about things, engaging with the broader set of actors to test or to make those assumptions more valid, and so on. So in a way, this is my current thinking, also coming from one of my previous employers in MindLab, where we were an internal innovation lab that helped policy develop from within with some of these methods. Now I think we will try to develop those policy labs in broader coalitions of societal actors. So co-owned, co-created, co-designed with government, but also with a lot of other actors, and then anchored in a shared development agenda and anchored in almost like spaces outside of government, outside of all the organizations, because it's about that third place, really, where it's, you know, it's a shared responsibility and a shared kind of exploration of possibilities. So I don't know, I can't sort of say that there is a image of government like precisely, but there is certainly a shift from government as a provider or as the expert of analysis and policy development to a convener of collaborative mission-based transformation.
Well, we can see a little bit of that already, right? Because there are labs that are future labs, for example, that you could say that are more like thematic oriented or mission oriented, or also data related labs. No, Do you see other ones that they are already part of the ecosystem?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm being a little harsh here, but I think it often becomes either you're inside government, you're close working with ministries, or you're outside and you have trouble really gaining access to the political agendas and where I guess decisions are made and so on. So ideally, those actors that you are talking about will be much more integrated into those sorts of collaborations. And I think there's potential for these agendas, these sort of approaches, steps coming from collective impact over to systemic change and transformation practice towards embracing mission orientation as a common way of working, I think has the potential to really integrate those entities.
If there's someone, for example, a service designer working in a government agency, and they are they've been working maybe several years in this space where they get to renew services, make the government services more human-centered or user-centered, and now they recognize what you're saying, that they should be kind of pulling their work towards this mission approach and address these systemic challenges. So but I recognize from the community that they are kind of thinking, they're worried where to start, where to begin changing their work, how to move away from this renewing services into this bigger approach of systems change or missions approach. Like, what would be like the first step for them? Because we could use them as change agents. Like, these are people that have already infiltrated the government somehow, and they do have mindsets and they have good networks within the government. But how to kind of how to give them the push to become the agents for this missions approach? What do you think?
This is my limited knowledge of Finland, but as I recall, you have both people hired as designers in a larger organization. You have also design teams some places, right? So in both instances, I guess a main pragmatic thing would be for them to be able to work with the same partner within the same, I'm going to say mission, but it's not a mission, but it's in the same problem area over a long period of time. So that iterative approach, where it's okay to start with the service design stuff, But then over time, it becomes evident that actually in order for the service design to really make a true difference, that there's more fundamental organizational things that needs to happen. Or there's a more, or some sort of more fundamental systemic administrative innovations that needs to happen, or whatever it might be. That usually, it's my experience, becomes a sort of a natural evolution. If you are allowed to work long-term with the same partner. Mm-hmm. So in any respect, that I've done that, so both in MindLab and at Nesta, in States of Change, you see how a project can be small from the get-go, can have those ripple effects, and you're able to build on it within the same organization, within the same people, and within the same reform agenda, whatever it might be, you know, things will grow from there. So I think that's sort of a pragmatic lens to that. I guess the other thing, which I don't know how tough or how much kind of people, so we often talk about government officials being stuck in their ways, have a very rigid perception of what their profession is and what they're supposed to do and so on. Is that the same for designers? A little bit? Maybe some designers?
Well, we always think that we are going to save the world, right? We always think that we have the right tools to solve certain issues.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, and very understandably so, you kind of fall back on what you know and what you're trained to do or what you have done before, and you try to kind of make that the vehicle of the change you want to make. So I guess a lot of experiences that I hear from government officials working with designers is that they actually find them to be the less willing to change in terms of adapting their approach to the reality they work in. So there's a bit of that as well, where you can actually say, well, I might be really good at service design, but this kind of design that the challenge is calling for is actually quite different, though it's more fundamental, or it's more systemic. And if that's the case, where can you go to both learn, but also to be open to, challenge yourself on some of the things that you might be sure of otherwise?
Yeah, I think I recognize what you're saying, and that's why we're doing the futures process, is also to shake us awake and kind of like understand like how should our work, and how should we be changing, what should we be learning. And so and yourself, you're or at least you did your PhD in anthropology, so and you've been working as head of research. So I've been leading a team that has different types of professions within the team. So I'm interested in like, what are the different types of people that one should have in a multidisciplinary or transdisciplinary team? Like, what are the different professions that you might be collaborating with these days? Maybe you can start by, I don't know, thinking about the role of researchers or anthropologists in these kinds of settings, or what types of people should we have on board of these teams for working around missions or systems change?
Yeah, well, it's a timely question. Because I'm currently setting up a team that's supposed to do this and will be in the coming months. And funnily enough, I'm not thinking about their professional background at all.
The attitudes. Are you thinking in the attitudes, in the mindset?
That's definitely. So I guess my starting point is the experience they have, and not so much how long it is, but where they have been trying to make stuff happen. And I guess I'm looking at the ideal combination of being both having worked in or with government closely, having worked in civil society, making things happen from the bottom up, and ideally also have worked in some kind of change supporting entity, like a design unit, or it could be a consultancy as well, but where your role have been to kind of support and drive the change process to actually make things happen, go forward, and so on. So if I can find people that have all of those three and have significant dirt under their nails in terms of really trying to make that happen, I think that's a very strong starting point. because then you're able to put yourself in different positions. I mean, there could be some private sector in there as well. It would be great, but that's hard to find in the combination. But the point is that you are able to put yourself in different shoes, and you're able to understand the different logics that is in play. And if you are the person that's done that, you are also probably of the mindset that you actually require, which is being able to kind of adapt, learn a new kind of environment, you know, being able to understand the context you're in, being able to understand people that are different from you and what you usually is, and that sort of thing. So in a way, that tells a lot about usually at least, about who you are. And then beyond that, I think that there are some special skills that is crucial. And I think design is one of them when it comes to making the very complex process tangible, making the, you know, insights and learning what you learn and so on, making that available to people to engage with and so on. But it's really, I'm finding a much more a hybrid of design and storytelling and sort of learning design researcher kind of, that's almost like what I think is really crucial. So you are able to both engage in the complex process of learning things and understand the dynamics, you know, take that back, make something tangible out of that, and then to tell the story, the change story or the solution story or whatever it might be in different ways. I mean, again, I'm just dreaming here. I'm not saying there are many people out there that is that way, but that's the kind of special expertise that is really crucial. And then you have a few other roles, I think, in there, which one is more, a more nerdy role, if you say, around learning and portfolio-based learning, so learning across a lot of projects and being able to find patterns and make that a strategic resource of the work. And then a third one, which is probably a more traditional train-checking role, which is about creating the space for the work. So it's usually often the leadership role, but that is able to kind of have the charisma and the persuasion or the kind of the impact around it, around yourself, to be able to really create the mandate for the work on an ongoing basis. And that includes kind of being able to navigate in all of those different contexts and being able to make the case for the work in very different ways, depending on that who you're speaking to and so on.
Great. And what inspires you? What are you reading, listening, or watching in relation to design in public sector or innovation in public sector, I would say?
I should read more. I don't read enough. I can definitely admit that. It's one of my goals every year is to read more. I think at the moment, I guess what inspires me professionally is are the ones that are really stretching our thinking, both when it comes to the ambition level of ambition as well as the, you know, what you can then call the consequence of that ambition. Okay. So
what stretch your thinking?
So a guy like Indy Johar, beyond being a very charismatic and lovely man, is constantly kind of very much ahead in his thinking, and many of the models that they make in Dark Matter Labs, I think most people, including myself, have a hard time to understand. But they're working on a level of complexity that you can then kind of pick from or kind of steal from in snippets. So, for example, they work on the multi-level engagement at the moment, even though we're definitely not going to go all the way in when it comes to their approach. There are elements of it we can pick out and inspire our thinking. So it's really useful to have thinkers that are, because he is first and foremost a thinker that actually are able to kind of have the conversation and make things happen around him. So, and then back to the point about design, actually also having the element of trying to visualize what the hell is this very complex way of working actually look like, even though some of the visuals are also very hard to grasp. It's still, for me at least, really useful that someone kind of works on behalf of others to kind of really try to do that work and share it as much as they do as well.
But also when you are visualizing something, you are understanding it. So
yeah,
the process of visualizing together is something that gives some understanding on the topic.
I agree, 100%.
Is there some place we can follow your work? Because you've been doing all these amazing things and visiting Finland in the past few years, but kind of your current endeavors, and you're mentioning something about like gathering a team and so on. So is there a platform where we can follow your work and get inspired by what's next for you?
Or apply to your team. We
make a wish that please keep publishing and keep inspiring us.
So I'm publishing a little, some of the things that we are doing currently, both in Danish and English, later this spring. It's meant to be more than that we're currently doing. We want to make it a work out loud principle. But we are on a transition from now mobilizing this system and ecosystem towards action in portfolio-based development platforms and so on. So there's so many things that we're trying to make happen that we are unsure of. So we really need that conversation with the broader ecosystem around whether this makes sense at all and what others are doing and that kind of thing. So that would be great. And the initiative is called Invite Elle, which translated means a path for all, which is about marginalized youth. So it's a wide range of organizations. Bikuben Foundation is one of the initiators of that initiative. But it does draw, and my role in it as well is to draw on many of these experiences working with government or in government the last 15 years, and try to make that happen in this context. And I guess an advantage of being in a foundation is that you're a little more flexible in terms of what you can put into motion, right? And that particularly Bikuben Foundation here, that has already accepted that is, we need to do long-term stuff. We need to do systemic change. We need to experiment and so on. So there are some fights to legitimize that approach that I don't have to take at the moment, which means we can kind of extend beyond what we usually do, I think, in terms of how we approach things. So yeah, I'm obviously happy to share and stay in touch around that work. And there are many parallels also to previous conversations we've had, Annie, as well. Happy to do that.
Great.
Thank you. I would say thank a lot for this interview.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
This is the end of this series, Thinking on the Futures of Design in the Public Sector. I'm thankful to Annie Leppänen for allowing me to contribute to her ongoing research. I am always eager to better understand how to use podcasts as a research tool. This is why I do this type of collaborations. I have done 14 series in collaboration with researchers, and the practice will continue. I am also extremely grateful to everyone we interview as they share their perspectives and prompted us to reflect on our own work. I won't summarize their contributions here, but I will be writing a blog about the entire series as this is part of my practice. The blog will be posted on our website. I can give you a sneak peek of what is coming in the near future now. In our previous episode, we started a series on health, which will be mostly in Spanish, where I interview people who come or work in Chile, Argentina, Italy, Uruguay, Norway, Australia, Switzerland, Mexico, the Netherlands, and Finland. They are all designers who work in product design, services, strategic design, experience design, or design research. I think it turned out to be great, but you will let me know. I'm going to publish it in two parts because I don't want to bore those who are not interested in health. It's a series of 10 episodes. After that comes a series on biomaterials. This series was done with Heidi Hall as part of her research, exhibition, and upcoming book. We will try something that we have done previously, but in a new way. Use the podcast as part of an exhibition. This time, the exhibition will take place in Berlin. More about this in the coming episodes. Also, the topic of futures will be soon revisited, but this time we will not have a series on the public sector, but on future foresight and participatory foresight. As always, the music of the podcast is by Antonio Zimmerman. Sound design is by Andy Fecci. This podcast is published with Creative Commons license with attributions. This was Diseño y Diáspora. You can follow us on social media channels in YouTube, Instagram, or X, or visit our website. Remember to recommend us and recommend our books. Stay tuned for more. We've got lots in store. Till next time, goodbye, and design some more.